Welcome to the Poet's Voice, which is a program dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. My name is Eileen Cleary, and I'm so excited today to be interviewing Miriam O'Neill, the Poet Laureate in Plymouth, Massachusetts. This program is supported by America's Hometown Laureates. Miriam, I'd like to tell you a bit about Miriam. Miriam O'Neill hosts the poetry reading series Poetry in the Art of Words and has published three collections of poetry. We start with What We're Given, Kelsey Books, 2018, The Body Dialogues, Lily Poetry Review Press, 2020, and The Half-Said Things, Nix's Mate, 2022. In addition, O'Neill's poetry to her poetry and prose, she also translates Italian poetry. And I'm so excited to talk to this wonderful poet today. Hello, Miriam.
Hey, Eileen. It's good to be here.
It's always great to chat with you about anything related to poetry. I wondered if we could begin with a short poem of yours, and perhaps you'll speak about the poem.
I'd be happy to do that. Like you, I know that you are as much a book aficionada as I am. We love books. We love to hold books. We love to read books. We love to lend books and hopefully get them back. And my love for books started in a library because my parents made sure that we went to the library on a regular basis. So I'd like to read this book, this poem called Book Night. And it's dedicated to my brother Patrick. And if anybody is listening from the Plymouth area and you're old enough, you'll remember the original Manomet branch of the Plymouth Public Library. In the Manomet branch of the Plymouth Public Library, Mrs. Carklin stamps books and cards. Each date shines on its yellow legend. The open spines make boats and roof lines, a seaside village of fiction and natural history, poetry that mounts as dates dry inside. The cards she's pinched from each slot stack up as she teeters, the stamp first on its ink pad, then on the line. The pencils in their holder, the telephone in its perch, jump as she dates each book's return. We're taking home a collision of sensibilities. The case of the black orchid, the book of snakes, the fairy queen, and for you, again, White Fang, the story of the wolf dog born into violence who kills a man to save his master. Each time you read the story, you're saved too. Dad comes back from buying beer, approves each book, and pays the penny fines. Piled in the station wagon, we ride in and out of yellow pools of light. Our own street, black as a page at night. This is the place we'll run from, the place we'll never stop referring to as home. But tonight, all we know is the sound of snow chafing the cedars, that we have dreams we never tell, and that in spite of some who beat him bloody, the brave wolf dog will learn to love the man.
Such a beautiful poem. And there's so much said in that one line about each time you read the book, you're saved again. So I feel like as poets and right. avid readers.
Yeah, and actually this poem started, the origin story of this poem is in that line because I was reading an essay on the life of Jack London, who wrote that book, White Fang, and I had a flashback to my brother borrowing it over and over again. I think he probably could have read it out loud, mm-hmm. recited it out mm-hmm. loud, the story, on his own.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And congratulations, too, on being named Plymouth's Poet Laureate. I know this is you're the second poet laureate ever in Plymouth, and that's very exciting. Can you share what a day in the life of a laureate might look like?
Well, no 2 days are the same, but in general, what I'm doing as laureate is working with the organization America's Hometown Laureates, Inc., to create and support programming for poetry in Plymouth and the surrounding area. Mm-hmm. We're sharing with the rest of the South Shore. So a day-to-day business of laureating is pretty varied. Yesterday I met with Jennifer Harris, who's the president of America's Hometown Laureates, and we were discussing ideas for poetry programming for 2026, and we have some really interesting possibilities coming up.
Wonderful.
Last year we did a beautiful event, two beautiful events at the Spire Center that were all free, that involved poetry. One was involved the story of Emily Dickinson, and another one and how her poems came to be saved. And the second one was Robert Pinsky, who was a former U.S. poet laureate, and he brought his jazz band, his quintet, to Plymouth. So we have a lot of fun. And it's great to work with America's Hometown Laureates because they are able to help us find the funding to do the kind of programming that we do. And I get to be a consultant.
Nice.
With regard to the poets and the format and such of the programs. So it's a lovely way to work.
Yeah, it sounds it. And it sounds like a group of you together can make a really big impact in Massachusetts.
I think that's happening, yes.
And it just both expands and makes smaller the poetry community. I think that's beautiful.
It's more intimate, yes.
Yeah. And thinking about the mission of exploring power and place of poetry, how and where were you introduced to poetry, and when did you start writing it?
Well, I've been thinking about that since you asked that question, and it's a common question to be asked, but it's an important question because it's important for us to keep in mind our own origin stories as poets. And I would have to say that I can't remember the first poem I read, but I do remember that the first poem I heard would have been a song. Obviously, we all hear songs when we're little. And, of course, it rhymed, so it was a poem. And it was, the situation was just wonderful. My mother loved to sing, we called it Sing Up the Moon. Yeah. She had this thing that she did. She'd say, let's go sing up the moon.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And we lived quite near the Manamet Bluffs, and the moon came up over Cape Cod Bay. So she'd take us all down to the bluff, and just at dusk or whenever it was going to be moonrise, and she'd sing the song, I See the Moon, and the moon would come up, and it would keep coming up and keep coming up. So I assumed that she was creating the moonrise with that song, that she was summoning the moon. So I figured poems have big power if they can do that. And my first poem that I ever wrote is also related to that very space, the bluffs at Manamet. And I think I was 8 years old when I wrote a poem called Sea Breeze and tried to describe all the things that I thought contributed to the smell of the ocean or the beach. Pine trees, sand, mud flats, the rugosa roses up on the bluff. And somebody wrote to me maybe 10 years ago and said she still remembered that poem.
Uh-huh. That's so sweet.
So it's wonderful. I got an early start with my fans.
That's wonderful. I think it's great that it's very romantic and almost unheard of in some corners that parents can be that instrumental in allowing that type of expression so young. That's wonderful. And tell me, as you grew up and you were reading other poets and writing more, how was reading and knowing other poets and their poems, how has that contributed to your understanding of poetry in your own work? And also, kind of, what does that do for you as a poet?
Well, I liked what you said in your when we interviewed you about the idea that poems go across the ages and across time. Because when I first came to poetry, of course, I learned it in school lessons, and all the poets I learned about were dead. Mm-hmm. And most of them were white men, and they were dead.
Yeah.
And Emily Dickinson, and Phyllis Wheatley, and Anne Bradstreet. But they were all dead. Mm-hmm. And so I assumed that poets were people who were dead, and mm-hmm. that you didn't get to be a poet until after you died. That's a child's way of, you know, yeah. a logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got older, but I loved the poems, so I just kept reading them and learning to recite them, and I wanted to understand what made them tick, mm-hmm. what drew me to them, like mm-hmm. how did they work, what was the mechanism at work there, and sometimes I didn't get a poem at all, I just didn't get it, but I wanted to do it anyway. I wanted mm-hmm. to listen to it and say it out loud and so forth. So I just accept it. And so when I became a teacher at university, I didn't teach my students to analyze poems. And I'll tell you what, they were thrilled not to have to analyze a poem. We just would read poems together and we'd talk about what we liked in the poem and what it made us think of or how it made us feel. Or if we got confused, what was confusing. And we left it at that. And I think I made some converts that way into people reading poetry. I didn't make them write reports. I promised them that there's a poem for everyone, but not all poems are for everyone. So we were just exploring. And I kept reading and reading, and they kept dying, the poets. Anne Sexton died, Sylvia Plath died, Elizabeth Bishop died.
Mm-hmm.
But that's life, isn't it, the dying part? And then I figured out how to reach out to a living poet. And in my 30s, I wrote short notes to a few poets whose work I liked. And I actually got some notes back.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me so excited because I was like, oh, these are people in the real world. These are people I can actually reach out to. And Galway Cannell wrote to me, and Gerald Stern wrote to me, and I got very excited about that. Hmm. And we did not have a correspondence, I will say that, but it was nice to have a note.
Yeah.
And, so then having people now like yourself and other writers, other poets in my daily life and in my world just helps me what's the word? Stay the course.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the phrase is stay the course. And not worry that I'm not writing enough or that my poems aren't good enough. I just write.
I love to hear that.
Imagery?
Can you tell me a little bit about your reading series in Plymouth?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I'd love to talk about it. Poetry, the Art of Words, was started. It's been in existence for more than 20 years now.
Mm.
Almost 25. And it was started by a young man from Plymouth, Mike Amato, and a man from the Boston area, Jack Scully. And Mike asked Jack to help him start a series because he had this vision of what he called a poetry trail that would lead all the way from Boston down the South Shore to Plymouth, and that there'd be poetry everywhere. That was his goal. And unfortunately, we lost Mike very young. He died I think he was only 29 or 30 when he passed away. But he began this mm-hmm. thing called Poetry, the Art of Words. And in the beginning, there were just maybe 10 people who met once mm-hmm. a month. And now we sometimes have as many as 50 people show up. And we have a wonderful open mic, and we have guest readers who come from all over New England and beyond. And we meet from September through June at the Center for the Plymouth Center for the Arts on North Street. And anybody who wants to come could come. It's free. It's open to the public. And that's just great. Hop on the Center for the Arts website, and you'll see our calendar.
Wonderful. Now, can we get back to your work a little bit more? One of the most striking things about your work is its imagery. Often for scene setting, sometimes for tone, but always beautiful. Can you say a bit about how these images come to you? Are they consciously placed in the poem? Do you think in images or words? And does the poem demand the image, or does the image demand a poem?
I love this question. I love this set of questions because I hadn't really thought about it, about how the images in my poems work. And I'll work backwards, and I'll say that many of my poems are inspired by a flashback or a split-second image or a memory. And one in particular is a poem, an example I'm thinking of, I thought of when you asked this question, is Electric Sisters, which I'll read later. And it uses the image of how static electricity makes your hair stand up and do wild things when you brush it. And I was trying to brush my own hair on a winter day, and my hair was doing that thing. It was standing up all around my head. And I had a flashback to a scene that a girlfriend from high school had once described of herself and her sister and her mother sitting in a row, brushing the hair of the next one in front of them. And I knew that the sisters, the three women, the mother and the sisters, were very close. And that was such an intimate image to think of. And so I started with that as the place where that's where the poem starts. But it's really a metaphor for that intimacy and the closeness of those sisters. And I thought, well, my friend had described this, and I wanted to bring it to the page. So I guess I wasn't placing it. I was using it as a starting point, a jumping off point. And I began to think, when you asked that question, I read the question that you were going to, this question, I thought, it's like Seamus Heaney used to say that a poem has a threshold, that the reader, the poet needs to create a threshold for the reader to cross over or cross into the space. And I think lots of times my images that I start with in my poems are that threshold, that place that where the reader can cross into a space
that's
to be with the poem.
Said. Yeah.
And I think the only thing the other thing I'd like to say is, I don't know if I think in images, which is part of one of the questions you asked, but I know that once an image presents itself, I feel like it's a trail marker in the woods. I just have to follow it.
Yeah.
It's showing me which way to go.
Yes. That's wonderful. And like you said, it also shows the reader where to go and welcomes them in. Wonderful. Well, this has been so wonderful just to share this time. And now we get to hear, hopefully, a few more of your poems and any words you might want to say about them.
Well, I think I'll start with the poem Electric Sisters that I just mentioned. And it's in memory of Becky Flynn. And it was dedicated to her sister, Eileen Flynn. And I would like to add that Eileen has also passed in the last year, and I learned that a friend brought this poem to Eileen's memorial service and read it, and her daughter, it was the first time her daughter had ever heard it, and she requested a copy of it. So I'm very happy. That's what I want poems to do, is give you something that helps your heart.
Yes.
So Electric Sisters. For EF, in memory of Becky. I have a memory of your memory, a mother and two daughters unnested nesting dolls, all facing in the same direction, ash blonde and blue-eyed, the older sister brushing her little sister's hair, the mother's brush crackling static as she brushes out the bigger sister. Sparks fly. Both girls jump. Strands of hair rise to meet the bristles as if a levitation spell's been cast. All that winter, the same ritual as the sun rises. All day in school, the girls, electric current running down the hall from one homeroom to the other. And on the bus, one's hand beside the other's, heads bowed over magic books as winter's skyline flashes by in lavish crimson streaks through naked trees. Home is your sister. Brushes on the dresser side by side, the mother, having combed them clear, reserves a strand or two as keepsakes. This is the memory that opens as I read your news. The breath of sisters, sweet as apple wood burning. So that's Electric Sisters. And that comes from The Half-Said Things, which was published by Nix's Mate in 2022. And now I'd like to read another poem. Book Night came from The Body Dialogues, which was published by yours truly, Lily Poetry Books. So I'd like to read this poem. It's a little bit long, but it uses anaphora, which is repetition, and it's a travel poem. And if you have traveled to a foreign place and tried to learn it, all the little details you have to keep track, you try to keep track of, mount up. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those poems. It's called Water. We drink from a stone box in an ancient wall. We drink from a copper spigot with a lion's mouth. We drink from the Alps transported. We drink from arches crossing valleys and rivers. We drink from the hands of slaves nailed to crosses along the road to Gaul. We drink from pine woods, terraced fields, rock gorges, wind farms in the east. We drink from city-states, their mines outside of town, their cathedrals. We drink from each Caesar, especially Augustus in his little house. We drink from Lydia's cruets and urns, her breasts buoyant in rose-petaled water. We drink from palms stretched in supplication, in condemnation, in applause. We drink from the graves of each poet and painter buried in the English cemetery. We drink from the Senegalese illegals selling fake pashminas on Via del Croce. We drink from the thong shops and nail shops near the Termini. We drink from the woman in kenta cloth who strolls without a purse, her heels cracked and dusty. We drink from the men standing, sipping espresso, grappa, vino. We drink from the spray paint artist squatting on her heels on Via Barbieri, who switches out her templates as she builds her own fountain. We drink from the flecks of green on green in the pistachio gelato, the swirl of red framboise. We drink from the gypsy women begging, their babies' heads lolling on their arms. We drink from the light of palazzos and piazzas as dusk settles on the city. We drink from rain-freckled streets, the red metro cars hurtling underneath the streets. We drink from the tiny sparrow picking crumbs between stones at the Arch of Triumph. We drink from the bride and groom who pose before the arch. We drink from the rush of water in the shade of the Palatine. We drink, we wet our hands, we wet our arms, we splash our faces with the flow of Rome. We drink. So,
absolutely stunning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And that was kind of a long poem. So I think I'll close with two shorter poems. This one is from my first book, We Start With What We're Giving. And it goes back to my brother Pat, who features in a lot of my poems because he was the first and we miss him dearly. This is called The Blessing. The night my father kissed my brother Pat on the neck, it was summer, and the crescent moon had already set, and we were sitting up late on the patio singing something from Carousel, maybe Mr. Snow, maybe If I Loved You. And a car rolled in the driveway, headlights dark, engine cut. And my father flew out of his chair and ran down the path, so we ran too. And there was Pat in his navy blues, cap flat on his head, home from Saginaw. And our father came up behind him, arms open to take him in. And he kissed the only part of our brother he could reach that way, the nape of his neck. He kissed him. And then it was over, and years would pass, and they would leave this earth without another touch between them. But I carry them the way they were that night. Father kissing son, son leaning in to take the blessing. And I'll end with one more poem from the closing poem of The Half-Said Things. And people who are bird watchers, and I know there are many of you out there, know that there are names for every kind of flock, and sometimes multiple names. And I call this list poem, Little Consecrations. A plague of grackles, a clutter of starlings, a scold of blue jays, a churm of finches, any kind, a rafter of turkeys, a ubiquity of sparrows, an echo of mockingbirds, a drum of goldfinches, a bobbin of robins, a hover of hummingbirds, a charm of house finches, a chime of wrens, a dissimulation of chickadees, a blessing, a hermitage, a beatitude of bluebirds, a sky.
That's a sky I want to be under. Thank you so much, Miriam. I so truly enjoyed this time with you and talking about poetry and hearing your beautiful work.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a privilege to be sitting right next to you and hearing that. And thank you, too, to all who are listening for joining us. If you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your
Talking information
listings and future broadcasts of the Poet's Voice. Thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.